Hello and welcome to Love is the Message, a podcast about music, the dance floor and counterculture. My name is Tim Lawrence and I'm here with Jem Gilbert. Hi, Jem.
Hi. How are you?
Oh, one day we'll get this intro right. So we're into series six and we are going to record the second of what will turn out to be three episodes on punk, which very much brings us up to the year that we're focusing on during this series, which is 1977. But we did feel that we hadn't quite given as precise account of the emergence and very early evolution of punk as we would have liked to do. So we are dedicating these three episodes to that topic.
Yeah, right. In this episode, we are going to go from the early pub rock scene in Britain up to the point of the release of what is usually regarded as the first British punk rock single, The Damned New Rose. And last time, we really talked about the context of American proto-punk, as it's often called. Today, we're going to start off at least really talking about British proto-punk. And the normal account of the genesis of punk rock in Britain has it that the equivalent, if you like, of proto-punk from Detroit in the States is the London-focused pub rock scene of the early 70s. Pub rock is a really interesting phenomenon in British musical culture. So the pub rock referred to a scene more than a genre, although it was fairly recognisable musically, referred really to a handful of bands, an overwhelmingly one band, the most prominent. And what they were seen to have in common was that what they did was to play live on the pub circuit. A pub, I'm sure everybody listening probably knows this, but pub is short for public house. Traditionally, what people in Britain call what in the States is usually just called a bar. There isn't really any difference. It would just be like talking about bar rock in the States. Interesting to think about this because arguably pubs as live music venues had been central to the live touring circuit. They had been like the lowest rung and therefore in some ways the foundational rung of the live touring circuit for rock bands and rock and roll bands since the late 50s. So there wasn't necessarily anything really new about it. And the idea of pub rock as having this very distinctive formation and almost having a sort of ideology was very much a function of that moment of the early 70s. And it was very much, I think, a reaction against the parallel development of stadium rock and progressive rock as a sort of theatrical spectacle and indeed glam rock, as we've talked about on the Patrons episode, as a theatrical spectacle. The idea was that this was a musical scene which was good because it was grassroots, it was down home, it was authentic. It was played in context in which the musicians would be in physically close proximity to the audience. And it was dance music as well. It was, in some ways, it's probably the most developed version of rock music as dance music in the UK. And in that way, actually, it is quite close to sort of the funky rock and southern rock that's developing in the States in the early 70s. We haven't talked that much about on the show. So for all those reasons, I think it is really interesting. It's a really interesting phenomenon, and it develops a sort of ideology for itself that feeds directly into punk and into the whole idea of the indie, independent sector in the later 70s and into the 80s in a really important way. So a really interesting phenomenon and absolutely the key band of the British pub rock scene of the early 70s are a band called Dr. Feelgood. Dr. Feelgood, who come from Canvey Island in Essex. And Canvey Island is this sort of, it's not actually an island. It is a sort of, it's a coastal town. I think it's not exactly a peninsula, Canvey Island, is it? But it sort of sticks out a little bit. Canvey Island is probably best known to people in the south of England as a popular site for like caravanning holidays. That's what I always associate Canvey Island with. People who were into caravanning used to be one of the places they would congregate. Caravan being the British term for what in America is called a mobile home. I've never been there, but it's a sort of, you know, it's somewhere that's very, very close to London. So it's somewhere that people from working class people from London who were not rich, who would have even, it would have been a stretch for them financially to go have a holiday in Kent or Suffolk, would go on holiday to Canvey Island, like from the early 20th century. So it's a kind of interesting place. It's from Essex. It's from a region of the country which is generally associated with a pretty conservative suburban culture, a very white culture. But this is Dr. Feelgood playing this very funk-driven form of British rock music, which becomes very, very popular. They have a lot of hits in the early 70s. They're one of the biggest bands in Britain for a few years. And they develop such a loyal following that they are still playing to this day. Really, they are a very interesting kind of phenomenon. And I think not for the first time, actually, when thinking about some of this pub rock formation, I'm thinking about the early career of Bruce Springsteen as an interesting point of comparison, because you could make an interesting comparison between New Jersey and, you know, places like Essex, although they don't have the industrial infrastructure and, you know, the post-industrial work culture that New Jersey has, but they do have that sense of being like close to the place that is like the capital of the world, like close to London, but also far enough away from it that they're sort of defined by their difference from it and their remoteness from it. And there's something about that, well, I would just say a white working class experience, really, which comes through a lot of pub rock. But I think before we get any further with it, let's hear a bit of Dr. Feelgood. This would be a hit of theirs from 1974 called She Does It Right. So Tim, what do you think of that?
This is going to be my shock revelation that I've been holding on to. No, I'm being a bit silly, but yeah, I think it's great. There's something about my reaction to this which is not entirely dissimilar to my reaction to quite a number of the tracks that you had picked out for the previous show, which is, you know, first and foremost, this sounds like blues music to me, or R&B. And I think there's also something distinctively rock and roll like about it as well. To the point where I almost thought, like, why is this pub rock? That would be an interesting question you might be able to answer. Like, what if we really drill down on the sonic distinctiveness of pub rock? Because what you've spelt out and what we know is that this whole scene emerged in which bands were able to play in quite a kind of, you know, non-pretentious, very direct, you know, and generally quite good fun environment on a pub, you know, especially kind of over the weekends, presumably. But this, like so many, you know, rock musicians, their primary reference point is the blues and is rhythm and blues.
Yes.
And to a certain extent, rock and roll. It might just be that this is kind of like having a British vocalist and a certain dialect or manner of delivery that distinguishes someone who's British from largely from someone who is, you know, is American. So that's one possibility. There's something about it that just feels very grounded and very focused on the music itself. I'm wondering if anything in the 1970s wasn't a reaction in some way to progressive rock, because it's like disco's a reaction to progressive rock, punk is a reaction to progressive rock. So there's all of that going on. But I think that's probably true on some level as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, well, it's surprising to me. I mean, that you're having that response. It's definitely it's quite a pleasant surprise. And I didn't, I guess I've got more recent history with this kind of stuff than you have, but I'm also sort of remembering in some cases, like how much I like some of this. One more track now from a year later. This is a slower, slightly less energetic track from Dr. Feelgood, but I think formally it's very interesting in the way it sits in a particular musical genealogy. So let's hear a bit of Keep It Out of Sight from 1975. You walk right in. Nobody turn around. Got no connections. Okay, well, to me, this is really interesting because it's notable there's a slight reggae influence on the beat and on the way they're using the guitar. There's a bit of a ska-ska strum to the guitar, which I think is quite deliberate. But also, it's a kind of minimalist funk, kind of slightly angular already, minimalist guitar funk, which is going to be very, very influential on post-punk bands like the Gang of Four and the Au Pairs. They're going to do a lot of that kind of thing. What Simon Reynolds will at some point refer to as agit funk. And I think that sound, that agit funk sound, which, you know, I think is becomes more developed by the end of the decade and maybe is more immediately arresting in that developed form. I think it is, yeah, you can hear it here in an interesting way. You can hear how it's coming out of the influences that are around at this time in the mid 70s from things like reggae and funk. I think it's also striking. You really can't avoid the influence of reggae on a lot of British music by 75, 76. It's really saturating British music in a way. It isn't penetrating American music to quite the same extent. And I think that is interesting as well. And it will continue to be a really key element in pop music through into the mid 80s.
I think one of the things that comes through on this is, I'm trying to think through the general rhythm and blues kind of underpinnings of a lot of this music, which is the most striking thing to me about it. But just trying to think about the distinctiveness of all, it also goes back to the Stooges. I think a lot of it is about a stage presence and obviously a sort of a delivery. So preparing for this show, I was looking at the video of both of these Dr. Feelgood records you picked out. And I think if you're just listening to them, it's one experience. And if you then sort of see the band, it kind of becomes a slightly different experience. And there is something, like the lead singer is like, when he sings, his kind of fist is clenched and is sort of pumping slightly manically. There's a sort of intensity there, but there's just something that's coming through. I'm not really saying it's particularly distinctive from what Iggy Pop is doing necessarily, but this is the thing that sort of takes it slightly out of the realm of rhythm and blues. I still think it's probably got more in common to do with rhythm and blues than punk, but this is where it's beginning to shift, isn't it? In the gestures and the body language and something about the vocal delivery.
Yeah, I think that's all right. And of course, as you say, their roots are in the 60s R&B scene. I mean, they all played in R&B bands at that time. The name comes from a Willie Perryman song, a blues singer called Willie Perryman had this song, Dr. Feelgood. And that British blues rock scene is something we haven't really talked about much. I mean, that's what Led Zeppelin come out of. That's what, you know, it's the Animals and then War come out of, by kind of quite a long genealogy. And it is a really interesting moment. It's what Fleetwood Mac come out of as well. So it's a really interesting formation that a lot of different things emerge from, like British musicians in the 60s listening to the blues. And you sort of look at it now and you can think, well, this is, you know, it's a cliche of the analysis made by people like us these days. But, you know, that's what you get a generation of these mostly young guys who are basically enjoying more leisure and more kind of job security and less demands on their time at a young age than any other cohort in history. And, you know, they've got time and money to spend a lot of time sitting around listening to American blues records and develop their own interpretations from them.
If we just take, say, the Beatles, and you can think about the Beatles being a rock and roll band that does become a rock band. I mean, there's not this big end, you know. For me, a lot of a rock was about having a lead singer step forward as a distinctive charismatic figure, and then but it's also someone having a lead guitar, you know, someone who's playing lead guitar, and that was a big break from rhythm and blues. But once we're into pub rock, I mean, it's being caught. We're suddenly in the era where, you know, rock is consuming everything. But this, to me, is a lot more danceable than a lot of Beatles records, which is not to say it's better than the Beatles. I'm not trying to explore that at all. I'm just talking about this just being, you know, basically groove music.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it is. It's dance music. It's live dance music. That's what it's the intention, and that's its function.
So I just don't think it's rock music on some level. I think its primary allegiance is to rhythm and blues.
Well, I understand what you're saying, and what you're saying is consistent with a particular usage of that term rock that we've both tended to be fairly committed to. But indeed, it's not only these guys. It's also, you know, people like Grand Funk and the Allman Brothers and people in the States at this moment in the early 70s who would call themselves rock bands, but are much more funk driven and are primarily producing what is consumed as a kind of dance music by the audience. So I think there's more than one lineage of that term rock. And then most people by this point in history who are doing what you might call rock and roll are just using rock as a shorthand for it. It's just shorter, it's quicker to say rock. But then there is also this idea of rock, capital R rock, as a specific generic form that has all the characteristics you've just described to it. And, you know, I think it really begins with Dylan and kind of the figure of Dylan as this romantic poet fronting an electric rock band. I mean, also reference to rock and roll as like the true name for what you're doing doesn't stop being an element of this culture. So like Sabbath and Zeppelin will always say, oh, we're playing rock and roll, even though like some of what they're playing sounds like absolutely definitively. There's never a clear generic distinction between rock and roll and rock. And there's this quite clear, one thing that's interesting actually is, you know, we're really interested in this. I've been really interested in this. And I've had this line for years and years and years. I mean, it's been my line for decades. Rock is a different thing from rock and roll. And it emerges when it emerges on the electric side of Bringing It All Back Home, Bob Dylan record. And it emerges with this figure of, this ideological figure of Dylan as the sort of poet, bard, with playing an electric guitar. And it is that moment when like John Lennon is like incredibly impressed by this idea and always attributes that to him wanting to be a more serious sort of artist than someone who just wrote songs about romance that girls could dance to. So for me, that's the kind of birth of the idea of rock. But the reason why it's sort of interesting and contentious for people like us to make all these claims is because it becomes a really central tenet of rock ideology not to make that distinction and to say, actually, there's a direct lineage, there's an unbroken continuity, really, between the blues and rock and rhythm and blues and rock and roll and rock. And it is interesting to reflect on that, actually. And one reason why punk ends up becoming so important as a reference point for people is because punk is sort of the first moment when you have a set of people who are somehow in that guitar band lineage who don't want to say, oh, everything we're doing is actually just part of this tradition that goes back to, you know, the original Delta blues. They want to be making a break with the past, whereas mostly people have not wanted to. It's also why, and then you go into the 90s, there's this fascinating moment when Creation Records, or Oasis's label, they deliberately take an ad out in the NME, I think it was, to set a full page out to say, we think we saw the Sex Pistols live, we think they're the greatest rock band in history. And it was a way of trying to recreate and to reincorporate even the Sex Pistols into this idea of this kind of narrative of rock and roll and rock as this unbroken tradition, which would then, of course, include Oasis as its ultimate dialectical culmination. but that is really interesting. That is really interesting, and it is one reason why punk is so interesting as a phenomenon, but also quite difficult to talk about because the punk, there's this will to break with the tradition in punk, which isn't there for any of these other people. Even though it's kind of fascinating, you think about Sabbath, you put on Sabbath Second Album Paranoid. It seems self-evident they're doing something radically formally different from, you know, 60s blues, but they don't really see it. They're not really interested in that. They're not interested in emphasizing that difference, usually, like rhetorically. There's this idea that rock and roll is a kind of animating spirit which you're keeping alive in these multiple different forms. And I think that's all, you know, that is all partly at stake in the fact that they're calling it pub rock. And instead of, for example, saying, oh, we're doing rock and roll and these other people are doing rock and those are different things. Let's get on to another record. I think this is going to be the last of the sort of classic pub rock records. And formally interesting with reference to a lot of what we've just been talking about. So this is Nick Lowe. Nick Lowe very much comes out of that pub rock scene. And this is So It Goes from 1976.
I remember the night the kid cut off his right arm in a bit to save a bit of power. He got 50,000 watts in a big acoustic tower. Security's so tight tonight. Whoa, they're ready for a tussle.
Okay, so that was the first record released on Stiff Records. Stiff Records would go on to become one of the iconic record labels of the punk and indie scenes in Britain. It would be the Pogues label. It would be the label that releases the first punk rock single in Britain, which we are going to talk about later today, The Damned, New Rose. But fascinatingly, it wasn't the punk rock scene that it was initially associated with. It was the pub rock scene that it came out of. In fact, it was Brio, the lead singer of Dr. Feelgood, who reputedly put up the money to set up Stiff Records. It was founded with a loan from him. So there was clearly this sense of a sort of scene that had a very deliberately grassroots aesthetic that it was worth trying to preserve in pub rock, because that was the genesis of Stiff Records. And it would be Ian Dury's label as well. And Ian Dury was also seen as coming out of that pub rock scene. And that Nick Lowe record for me has this very interesting sort of aesthetic. It's this jaunty sort of white rock sound. To me, it's a kind of British, it is a British analogue of the sound on Bruce Springsteen's first album, Greetings from Ashbury Park. I'm really interested in the way that it has this very kind of dense lyric, which is quite, you know, sort of almost sort of fast talking sort of lyric, which is clearly, to me, is clearly influenced by that late 60s Dylan sound. Those records like Highway 61 and Blonde on Blonde, where, you know, he does these very, very dense lyrics, and it's the density of the imagery and the fact that you're sort of, it sounds like you're telling quite a complicated story rather than just writing a little love lyric, that it creates the vibe rather than anything specific to the content of the lyrics. And to me, there's something about this sort of jauntiness and this creation of a vibe, if not whether it's real or not, of a kind of vibe of intellectuality through the density of the lyric, which, you know, to me, it does say something about that very particular moment in history. This is music which is self-consciously coming out of the southern white working class in Britain, at a time when the political allegiances of that social group are the most left-wing they've ever been and the most left-wing they're ever going to be. You know, they're never going to be that left-wing again after this. And it somehow seems to speak about a kind of optimism about the possibility of a world in which, you know, the working class in Britain are going to continue to occupy political and cultural centre stage. This kind of urban communitarian music, you know, that's going to be played and danced to in pubs is trying to be both danceable and clever in a really interesting way, in a way which is, you know, surprisingly unusual. I think also the other key musical influence I think you can hear for me is Lou Reed. And again, it's Lou Reed's kind of cool urban intellectuality translated into the boozy bonhomie context of a British pub, which this is trying to create. And I think it does it quite effectively. And I think it's kind of an amazing thing to want to do. It's kind of an amazing thing to want to translate Lou Reed's alienated, smackhead, cool metropolitan intellectuality into a different kind of urban context, which is a bit warmer and a bit more optimistic. I think that's actually a really cool thing to want to do, and I think it actually does it quite well. And what did you think?
Yeah, it was another record that, to my surprise, I really liked a great deal. It seemed to anticipate somehow Billy Joel, which is not someone who I reference very often on this show, and I don't think I've ever particularly said I like Billy Joel. I don't know what's going on. I don't know if this is like the wider political climate right now, and just like just things that seem like unrelentingly bad. I mean, what's going on in Gaza is, you know, it's not like numerically the worst kind of period in history that we've ever encountered, but it's the first one that, you know, we've sort of many of us have followed, so you know, directly, including via social media. So I can't tell if it's just like just the desperate nature of politics, but or if it's just finding quite a lot of contemporary popular music culture to just be definitionally plastic. But, you know, this is yet another record that I wouldn't have at any point in the last 30 years necessarily expected to like. And somehow I'm finding myself liking it a great deal. So it's kind of sunny and you kind of want to click your fingers to it a little bit. Maybe if I listen to Billy Joel now, I'd sort of like Billy Joel for the first time ever. Honestly, I don't know what's going on. I'm probably going to regret saying all of this, and that's fine.
The thing that's really struck me when I heard that is that I'm pretty sure you could have played me that, and I would have even if I had hadn't known, I would have said that it could only have come from sort of, you know, late 74 to sort of early 76. It actually came out August 76, but it's very distinctive to that moment, and quite also reminiscent of people from around the same time, like Steve Harley and Cockney Rebel, although they don't normally get classified as pub rock, so we haven't included them. So. Very interesting. Of course, Nick Lowe would go on to have a pretty impressive career as a songwriter and a musician in various guises over the next decade or so.
You're listening to Love is the Message.
Okay, I think that is what we're going to say about pub rock, which I think is this really interesting formation. But did punk ever really exist? Well then, world. We're going to go back. That was from August 1976. Allow me to take you back a few months further in time to listen to This Is the Ramones.
Oh, for God's sake.
Blitzkrieg Bop. Okay, we talked about the Ramones on the episode that we did about New York proto-punk a couple of years ago, but they're so important to this story that we have to talk about them again. The Ramones, this band from Queens in New York, pretty young when they start playing, they're playing, and they become one of the first bands to get a big reputation playing at CBGBs. Have this very distinctive style, which they never really lost, of kind of biker jackets and tight black jeans, but also sort of shoulder length straight hair. They never adopted the punk hairstyle. So it's very, very distinctive. Kind of, I mean, really absolutely reminiscent of the Stooges on the cover of the first Stooges album. I mean, that looks like, it looks like that's what they're trying to look like all through their career. But also sort of black shades and a lot of wearing black, which is, again, looks immediately reminiscent of the Velvet Underground. That's what they're doing sort of in terms of their mode of self-presentation. They're also one of the first bands that I know of to adopt what becomes this punk trope of taking on stage names. They all call themselves something Ramone throughout their careers, you know, Joey Ramone, etc. And this record, I mean, whether you love it or hate it, it does exemplify a very distinctive style. I mean, this is, and I think this is, and I'm, of course, I'm not alone in saying this at all. This is the moment when punk rock emerges as a recognizable style of music. It uses this thrashed guitar. It's not just a kind of skanking, ska-derived, like, you know, guitar. It's positively thrashed. which means that you are playing, even when you're playing, holding one chord, you're strumming very hard, very fast to create this feeling of frenetic forward motion. And then there are chord changes, but they're always very simple, very easy chord changes, because they are, when they are made quite quickly. This is very fast bass line. This is very frenetic drum beat behind it. And there's this vocal, which is sort of shouted as much as it's sung. There is also a very simple melody. You know, melodically, it has the simplicity of a nursery rhyme, really. And that's not saying that's a bad thing. That's partly what makes it so effective.
So that's an insult to nursery rhymes.
And there's quite a lot of... And there's also this use of chorus quite a lot. So they're shouting, singing together as well as alone quite often. Now, what it is the Ramones were actually up to with all this... To this day, you know, it remains a matter of critical controversy, because there are some people for whom this was a revolutionary statement of proletarian rage. And it was the sonic formal fountainhead for what would become things like anarcho-punk in the 80s. It had very deliberate and explicit political identifications. It would be one of the main inspirations for people like Black Flag and Henry Rollins in the States, or the Dead Kennedys. There's that version of it. I mean, the Ramones themselves in interviews and such were always kind of evasive or uninterested when it came to the question of defining what they were doing. If they had to give an answer, they would say, well, it's just rock and roll. They had this sort of primitivist, almost reactionary idea about what they were doing. They would sometimes use phrases, like deliberately provocative phrases, I think, like stupid rock, like it's supposed to be stupid, which is clearly a fairly direct reaction to the status that ideas like progressive rock had at the time when they started, and their perceived elitism. And I think it is sort of doing all of these things at the same time. Like, it is sort of extraordinary. It's sort of extraordinary, and it always seems to be... It's one of those things where you can imagine a world in which this just never happened. Like, or everything that followed from this never happened. Like, lots of other things have happened in music. So it could just have been that no one ever did this. Although, as we're about to find out, that's probably a stupid statement of mine to make, because as we are about to hear, other people did do pretty much exactly this at the same time. Clearly what they're doing, it is giving voice to a certain sense of both possibility, which is experienced by young people at this time. Like, anything could happen. The future is unwritten, as Joe Strummer and The Clash would go on to say one day. And the fact that you're not an incredibly highly trained musician who can do 10-minute improvised blues solos and sound really good shouldn't stop you from expressing yourself. This is in some ways the ultimate culmination of the garage band aesthetic. I mean, if you think about the fact that, for example, the Nuggets compilation had been released several years before the Ramones released anything, it is like the people releasing things like Nuggets were laying the ground for a band like the Ramones to emerge. And this is sort of the fulfilled promise of the whole idea of 60s garage as a specific aesthetic and as almost a specific ideology. So in all those ways, it is really extraordinary, but it's also kind of reactionary. It sounds very masculinist. It's very, you know, it's almost kind of macho. It seems like, well, if that's what it means to express yourself as a young white, a working class guy, is just to shout a lot, you know, then maybe that's not really doing anything apart from confirming a particular place in the cultural status hierarchy you're never going to change. And, you know, obviously, from the point of view of somebody who likes like acid rock and psychedelic rock and jazz, you know, the complete ejection of all those features from the music of people like the Stooges to produce this pure distilled white noise is sort of potentially problematic as well. So I think all those things are happening at the same time with this. One shouldn't ignore, and we don't like to ignore, the pharmacological context. You know, this is music designed to take speed and drink cheap beer and kind of jump up and down to hard, so getting your endorphins going. You know, there is a particular joy in doing that. You know, I've done it. I mean, it sounds even weird to say I've done it, because like somebody with my name did it like 40 years ago, like this, nearly 40 years ago. So like, it's not something I've done recently, but you know, I've been to like, you know, hardcore punk gigs and taken speed and drunk Newcastle Brown Ale. And, you know, there was a kind of joy in it, you know, and to be honest, the joy comes almost entirely from the endorphins. That was the thing I eventually realized, that it was the jumping up and down for hours rather than drugs that made it good. So there is a kind of joy in it. There is a kind of joie de vivre of being expressed. And that is what people love about the Ramones, I think. There is a kind of joie de vivre, and it is a kind of pop music in that sense, these very short songs. But it is also, it's very specific, and it's also quite difficult to listen to, like if you're not in the right mood. And I'm gathering, and you're not a big fan of the Ramones, are you, Tim?
I'm not the biggest fan of the Ramones. This is like, what do I like and what don't I like? And, you know, quite reasonably, why would anyone even care about that? But yes, this is punk. This immediately sounds like punk. It's completely different. To me, it almost has nothing in common to everything we listen to so far on this show and also on the last show, even though we're looking at the evolution of punk, the emergence of punk. But it's as if this is a break with everything that has passed previously. Everything that we've listened to up until this moment sounds like as though it's self-consciously rooted and derivative of rhythm and blues, and has a groove. And this has, as you know, I can't really add a great deal to what you've said, because you've given a very good account of what this record does and how it does it and why it does it. But yes, it is a break. It does sound like punk. To me, what's going on here is there's a lot of aggression, which I don't think we've heard. There's been some sort of maybe some simmering kind of anger a little bit in some of what we've heard previously that is kind of distinctive from the longer history of rhythm and blues, perhaps. The idea to be generating a sound that is primarily focused on the generation of collective joy gets a bit wobbly at points with the Stooges, maybe, and so on, and with some of the other records bands we've been listening to. But this is very distinctive. It's very unusual. I can't quite remember any records. Well, this is a ridiculous thing to say, but anyway, it's because I don't have a good memory, but I can't quite remember us discussing another record previously in which it was like, this is not like something we've heard previously. It really marks a break from established genres and scenes and what's going on. And I think, and you did touch on this, it's self-consciously white. This was seen to be kind of punk's contribution to, in some respects, you know, ideological contribution. Is like, those of us musicians who are white, stop pretending we're black, because it's stupid to pretend you're black when you're not. And there's the beginnings of an intelligent politics there, perhaps, but it's quite a precarious one. It's not a very healthy sort of, you know, position to necessarily want to trumpet, to kind of make sure that you don't sound like you've got anything to do with black music. And there is this history of Johnny Ramone, I believe, and sort of on some level the wider punk scene, you know, flirting with forms of discourse and practices that definitely could be called racist. Or it's a provocation anyway. It's not always meant to be taken literally. The introduction of the swastika or Nazi regalia, or even some kind of, you know, racist jokes, are not always meant to be taken at face value. And sometimes it's about upsetting the liberal establishment. However, it's a risky terrain, and it's not one that I've ever felt comfortable on. We'll come on to talk about this a little bit more, but there is something kind of self-consciously artistic about a lot of New York punk. So it's gestural, it's performative, and that needs to be kind of understood. It's not just some pure kind of expression of something. There's a desire to be pushing at some boundaries in a way that could be described as, let's say, being kind of artistic. So I think that's partly going on. But I think the other thing that which you also said to, I think, towards the end of your little commentary, was that it's also pop music. I mean, it's short, it's sharp, it's, you know, it's a few minutes, it's catchy. That's also a very important element of what's going on.
Well, your point about the politics, you were right. You're right. It is. Johnny Ramone is famous, notorious, really, for having been one of the very few Republican, like Reaganite punk rockers. I don't think he was ever really involved with the far right, although you might as well be if you're going to go around endorsing Reagan and George W. Bush, which he did. Of course, that wasn't the politics of the rest of the band, as far as I know. Jerry Ramone definitely wasn't sympathetic to this view. But their place in subsequent culture is really sort of extraordinary. Of course, I'm sure most people listening will be familiar with that utterly bizarre, still really kind of early 21st century phenomenon of the Ramones t-shirt becoming like a huge fashion item, you know, with people who didn't have never listened to the Ramones. You know, it became a trendy thing for like teenage girls to wear who'd mostly had never heard of the Ramones, reported. I never stopped anyone and asked them actually, but because their iconography is kind of very influential. Yeah, it's the biker. I mean, they really are the band that make biker jackets like a thing. And they also, they have this little shtick of having a uniform. They all dress the same, which is not the new thing. The Beatles did that for a bit. But they have this sort of uniform. They all take the same stage surname. And they had that famous, that logo, which is it's a kind of mocking pastiche of a sort of military badge or a police badge or something, or like a coat of arms that has their names around the outside of the circle. But it was so visually striking that it became this icon of fashion. So they do have this very significant place in the culture, I think, and in musical culture. And there's a huge amount of affection for them, like especially in the States within sort of alternative culture. I have quite a lot of sympathy for them as a band, actually. I mean, Blitzkrieg Bop is a weird record that no one's ever really known what it's about. I have a bit of sympathy. I quite like a lot of their later songs, and they seem to have been quite thoughtful people and seem to have seen themselves. They're a bit like Iggy Pop. They're a bit like Devo. There's one of these bands who seem to have seen themselves as committed to the singularity of a specific project to a degree which was in excess of any capacity they had to really justify it verbally. There is something about them which I do think is sort of lovable and compelling. Although, you know, that there's been like about 3 hours of my entire life when I have felt in the mood actively to listen to the Ramones on purpose. So I completely understand why you don't like them aesthetically, but I share something of that affection for them. And I sort of have, they're sort of fascinating because they become sort of indispensable. You can't really talk about music after the Ramones without the Ramones being part of the discussion and the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I really do want to emphasize that just because it's not a music that appeals to me is completely irrelevant here. I could recognize their complete originality and also brilliance and also appeal to a slightly sullen frustration that, you know, can erupt into sort of something that's more aggressive as being something which is, you know, expressive of, you know, wider demographic audience and so questioning of the punk was a bit like this, like when is disco supposed to have begun, and these, you know, maybe it's a very boring question for many people, but to me it's like something emerges and then you just, you know, the historians come along and say, oh well, actually it's the same with hip hop, it's the same with disco, I think it's the same with punk. We go and we identify all these, you know, proto and pre examples that we say have led up to this. But to me, sometimes if you're following the chronology, it sounds a lot more like R&B than punk. So why would you even be thinking of punk without punk having come along? And the retrospective reading is not very helpful, really, even in understanding it in sort of what we could even call musicological terms. But yes, so that was a question about whether punk even exists. But, you know, here it exists. There's no question of that. And then it carries on existing. Although, you know, there's some of the stuff that still gets called punk after this moment when punk is very explicit. Some of those later articulations also don't necessarily feel very punk.
Yeah, I think, and the other thing I think one has to stress with reference to the Ramones, though, is that it's also fun. I mean, when I was part of the sort of Northwest England punk scene in the late 80s, the Ramones were the thing that always seemed to demonstrate that punk could be fun and humor and have some humor about it. They didn't have to be just like deadly serious angst and anger. And, you know, my former PhD student, Pierre Rabou, who did his PhD at the University of Lausanne, about mainly about European punk. You know, he ended up coming to the conclusion that for people who were into and influenced by punk rock in continental Europe in the late 70s, it was fun. It was the idea of fun and a kind of subversive sense of humour that was really important to them. And that's going on in the Ramones all the way through. I mean, the whole thing is, I mean, partly what's going on, and we're going to come back to this when we talk about Blondie, partly what's going on with the Ramones is, of course, the whole thing is sort of in quotes. The whole thing is sort of arch. You know, they're not entirely serious. So you can't be entirely serious about insisting on all wearing drainpipe jeans and biker jackets and cutting your hair like Iggy in 69 and calling yourselves the Ramones. You know, you can't be entirely serious doing that. And they're not entirely serious. The whole thing is a sort of commentary on the idea of being in a teenage garage band, as well as being a teenage garage band. That is one of the things that makes them so interesting. They're never really going to answer the question, like, about how serious they're being when people ask them, but they're clearly not 100% serious. Although they are also serious, they also mean it at the same time. They permanently put into question the whole notion of whether there's really a distinction between, you know, being performative and being authentic. And that's part of the performance, that's part of the act, that's part of what they're doing. And I think that is sort of interesting as a project. So the next band we're going to play are contemporaries of the Ramones, and they are really, really fascinating phenomenon. If you have not heard about this band before, but the rest of the story is familiar to you, then this will kind of blow your mind. What I'm going to say is this record was released in September 1976, but an awful lot of historiographical work has been done to try to determine to what extent this band developed their sound in imitation of the Ramones or simply parallel to the Ramones. And the general consensus among the people who studied it is that it is the latter, that they sounded just like this before the Ramones had released anything for them to listen to when they were playing in their parents' garages or their bedrooms or, you know, at home. And this is a band not from New York, not from London, not from Essex, not from New Jersey. This is a band from Queensland in Australia. This is the Saints, Stranded.
Like a snake calling on a phone, I've got no time to be alone. Summer coming at me all the time, you better think I lose my mind. Cause I'm stranded on my own, stranded far from home. Alright.
So pretty extraordinary. The Saints, now they are kind of icons of Australian music culture for quite good reason. As I say, it's fairly well established that they had this sound, which is very, very similar to the Ramones and very similar to the Damned, who we're going to hear. But they had it sort of before they had heard the Ramones. They developed it pretty much generically from having similar sources and similar resources available to them. And this record itself, I think it's a pretty compelling version of early punk rock. And it really is sort of fascinating. And the story of the Saints is the story of alienated youth in what was at the time an incredibly conservative, incredibly right-wing politically region of Australia. I think the political left in Queensland has had some success pretty much for the first time in the history of the state, I think, over the past few years. But at the time, it was notoriously conservative and remote, and people living there often felt like they were far away from anywhere. And really, really kind of extraordinary, but also for me, a great exemplification of the idea that punk, although punk is associated with New York and London, it often seems like the audiences with whom it had the most powerful resonance were people not living in these great metropolitan centres, but people experiencing the kind of relative cultural deprivation of life out in the suburbs. Anyway, Tim, you got any thoughts about that?
My thoughts were that I quite like it.
Yeah, I like it, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting that this was taking place in Australia, and I think we probably, I don't know how well we do at trying to not ascribe originary kind of pioneering influence to any number of artists.
Just let me just say, I don't know any band or pair of bands that this level of work has been done on to figure it out. Yeah, because it's a huge deal for people invested in kind of Australian musical history. The idea that the Saints invented punk rock at the same time as the Ramones. So I'm not saying it's like usually an important question, but a huge amount of work has been done trying to figure this one out. Anyway, sorry, go on.
All I'm trying to say is that there's generally trying to say that someone started something can be problematic.
Yeah, sure.
And this is particularly satisfying, not only because it's a great record and a great band, but also because it makes absolutely perfectly good sense that, you know, more than one lineup can have an idea simultaneously and can, you know, have that idea as a result of, you know, distinctive lineages. I'm as guilty or more guilty than anyone of trying to, let's say, attribute kind of this particular influence to someone like David Mancuso or what he was doing that was new. But when there's time to do this, the point about what David was doing was he was saying, well, I was doing this because of all these other things that were going on around me simultaneously. You know, lots of people can have a good idea more or less around, or at the same time, in, you know, whether it be in the same city or in the same country or the same part of the world or opposite ends of the world. And this is a good example of that.
Yeah, I agree. There's something about the tone of this which sort of anticipates bands like the Buzzcocks and the Undertones.
Exactly what I had in the notes I made was like, this is like the Buzzcocks.
Yeah, it anticipates all of those sort of more than the Ramones do, really. Partly because it is clearly very serious. It's very heartfelt. This, in a way that the Ramones is always kind of arch. And we might make similar comment about the next record we're going to play, which is usually historically registered as the first officially categorised punk rock record released in the UK before Anarchy in the UK. This is The Damned. This is New Rose, that was released in October 1976.
I've got a new rose, I've got a good. Yes, I knew that I always would. I can't stop to mess around. I got a brand new rose in town. See the sun, it shines. Don't get too close or it'll burn your eyes. Don't you run away that way. You can come back another day. I've got a new rose, I've got a good.
So The Damned are a London-based rock band, rock and roll band, coming out of much the same scene that will produce not just the Sex Pistols, but a lot of the London punk bands, which are going to start getting record contracts and releasing records really in 1977. Kind of interestingly, when I was doing research for this episode, I realised that in a way I hadn't really realised before that basically once the Sex Pistols phenomenon emerged towards the end of 76, there was such a scramble by major record labels to jump on the bandwagon that almost all of the London punk rock bands that any of us will have heard of got major record contracts in 1977. They all got signed in 77, because this was not only the next big thing, it was like the biggest, you know, most decisive next big thing in the history of music culture, as we've sort of discussed, you know, to the extent that a lot of it was probably always hype. But, you know, the hype had the effect of getting a lot of people signed to major labels. But The Damned, immediately coming before this great commercial wave, were signed to Stiff. They were on the same label. They were on Nick Lowe's label. They were on the Pub Rock label. It's interesting that their influences are obviously very similar to the Ramones, with whom they were familiar. They were obviously very similar to those of the Saints. And their first album features a cover of a Stooges song. So it's pretty clear where they're coming from. But the sound here is kind of interesting. It's interesting that it's a love song. It's a song about having... It starts with this weird little spoken line. Like, is she really going out with him? And the song is, you know, I've got a new rose, I've got a good, which, yeah, he's just saying he's got a new girlfriend, but he's happy about it. And it is fairly typical of the way the Damned are always, they're always slightly parallel to the rest of the punk scene. And they, again, they didn't seem to take themselves as seriously as the other London punk rock bands, although they also seem to have something of that quite arresting sort of pub rock authenticity about them, which the highly contrived performances of people like the Pistols maybe didn't have in the same way. You got any thoughts about that, Tim?
Yeah, I mean, what you just said is the, in particular, your last sentence or two is exactly what I had to say, really. So there you go. We agree. I don't know if it's more fun when we agree or when we disagree. I've written more authentic performance. So there's something in which, you know, with indeed the Ramones and certainly with the Sex Pistols, who we'll come on to talk about. There's something staged. It's a deliberate provocation. It's not really, you know, it's performative. Self-consciously performative, whereas this seems to be, you know, just a general set of sense of a simmering frustration that can tip into a sense of anger, rather than something that's just like concocted, exaggerated. So on some level, I just quite like that.
Okay, so we're going to leave it there with the Damned. I think we were a bit uncertain when we're recording, actually, whether we were going to finish with the Damned or with Blondie, but I think we've said enough and we've got to the Damned, which is the ending point we sort of wanted to get to. I think we are going to try to talk about Blondie next time, as well as finally getting into the context and the moment of the release of Anarchy in the UK and the entire phenomenon that was the Sex Pistols. And that should be enough for this punk rock little mini series. Does that sound good, Tim?
Yes, that sounds good.
Okay, great. Well, thanks, Tim. That was great.
Yeah, thanks, Jem. Well done for carrying us bravely through the early history of punk music. You've excelled.
Well, thank you very much. And thanks, everyone. If you like the show, please do give us a 5-star rating on whatever platform you're listening on. If you've got the money, then please do consider becoming a patron. We do always need the support, and there's now lots of extra material in the feed for patrons. And whether you do any of that or not, thank you very much for listening, and you will hear us again next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.